Good morning from New York, and welcome to the NIAC Talks podcast, Spotlight on International Arbitration in Latin America. My name is Rekha Rangachari, and I'm NIAC's Executive Director. We're delighted to offer different styles of programs during this period of shelter in place, where we can discuss topics on a lighter note and separate from COVID-19. We're quite fortunate to have so many of you from global jurisdictions on the line, so thanks to each of you for both your time and participation. Today, we embark on a three-part podcast series. In each session, we'll take a sampling of jurisdictions to understand how systems within Latin America and the rule of law evolve in parallel with an interconnected set of political, economic, and cultural challenges. Our topics will cover broadly the state of international arbitration within these jurisdictions, including review of legal infrastructure and its interplay with international order. In so doing, we'll highlight the distinctiveness of the Latin American experience, which lends itself to great intra-regional diversity. And we'll demonstrate how dispute involvement is not uniform across the region. These are political economies of variation within Latin America. I cannot underscore enough, today's speakers will give the big picture as we discuss in this first episode, change within the system. We look to Mexico, Argentina, and Ecuador. Each jurisdiction has demonstrated relevance within international arbitration by modernizing practices, change in administration affecting change in policy, and keeping each on the main stage from key power seats of Mexico City, Buenos Aires, and Quito. We offer three main considerations for each jurisdiction. First, political changes compared to the prior regime. Second, the effects of these changes on investment arbitration. And third, the effects of these changes on commercial arbitration. I'm joined by two leaders in international arbitration known to many of you, who also hail from NIAC founding firms. Noyana Marigo, partner at Freshfields Bruckhaus Derringer. She is chair of its U.S. International Arbitration Group and co-chair of its Latin America practice. Anibal Sabater, partner at Chaffetz Lindsay and member of NIAC's Board of Directors. Each will take one jurisdiction, Anibal beginning with Mexico, then Noyana on Argentina, and both will join on Ecuador. Now, three administrative items to all delegates. First, this session is being recorded. Second, as we progress through these topics, please submit your questions within the Q&A portal in Zoom. And finally, in the materials previously circulated, you should have received the reading materials and the CLE affirmation. Remember to complete the CLE affirmation and return to Bill Kaczmarek, who was included in copy. With that, I turn the floor to Anibal and Noyana.
All of our virtual listeners, I look forward to the time, hopefully soon, when it will be safe to do events like this in person again. I'll start by talking a little bit about Mexico. And if you've been following Mexico and international arbitration, obviously the most significant development you've had to deal with has been the legal and economic policies of the current administration, Mr. President López Obrador's administration. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was sworn into office in December 2018, and he has adopted an economic and foreign investment agenda which departs significantly from that of his predecessors, including Mr. Peña Nieto, his immediate predecessor. We are now talking about an administration that believes in strong government intervention in the economy, sees with an enhanced degree of suspicion foreign investors, and is trying to slow down the process for the entry of private players in the oil and gas market in particular, and the energy sector in general. We decided that it would be a good idea to call this session Change Within the System, because what's remarkable about President López Obrador's policies, as well as the policies from the countries we're going to be discussing today, is that even though they mean and they imply a very significant swing in the political and legal pendulum, this swing has taken place without amending the Constitution and to a large degree within the parameters of the existing Constitution. If you look back at the 1990s when you had this eclosion of the Bolivarian ideology and brand new administrations making it to power across Latin America, one of the first things those administrations did was to start new constitutional processes and change the rules of the game. And at best, that meant 2 or 3 years of significant constitutional and legal uncertainty for the key players in the market. And at worst, it meant over a decade of tinkering with the system. Interestingly, that's not what's happening in the jurisdictions we are discussing today. When Mr. López Obrador and his ministers were sworn in, there was a fair amount of prediction that the number of investment claims against Mexico was going to go into overdrive. There was going to be a landslide of claims against Mexico. But that hasn't really been the case. The administration has managed to keep its standing within the international community, and the number of investment claims brought against it to a minimum, or at least at the steady level at which it was before López Obrador and his team were sworn in. And there are a couple of examples that show that very clearly. In late 2018, early 2019, the administration canceled the contract for the construction of a new airport in Mexico City. They believed the old one should be expanded and no new one was needed. The members of the consortium which was building the new airport immediately complained and threatened investment claims against Mexico. Those didn't materialize. The government was able to settle with the consortium members and pay them what apparently they deemed a fair, proper, sufficient compensation. Same thing happened with gas transportation companies. The government, the new administration had made it clear that they were quite unhappy with the long-term gas supply agreements that some gas transportation companies had entered into with Comisión Federal de la Electricidad, CFE, that's the state-owned electricity monopoly. They were particularly unhappy with force majeure and take-or-pay clauses in those contracts. And the government knocked on the door of its contractual counterparts seeking a renegotiation of those clauses. Some of those companies initiated contractual arbitrations against Mexico as a result, but based on the publicly available reports, it appears that all the claims have been settled and none of these cases has been elevated to an investment arbitral tribunal. Now, this is very different from the situation you saw, for instance, in Venezuela in the early 2000s, when PDVSA, which is somehow similarly aligned with Mexico's CFE, knocked on the door of international oil companies seeking a renegotiation of joint operating agreements. And some companies were very unhappy with the terms proposed to them and took Venezuela to investment arbitration. The administration in Mexico has managed to avoid becoming the new Argentina or the new Venezuela in terms of being a frequently sued state in investment arbitration. When it comes to legal treaties in Mexico, it's remarkable that all this has happened. The landslide of claims that was somehow predicted by doomsayers has been avoided, even though Mexico, which had long been a holdout to the ICSID Convention joined the ICSID convention in mid-2018, shortly before Mr. López Obrador was sworn in. More recently, Mexico has renegotiated NAFTA with Canada and the US, and the resulting treaty, the USMCA, that's the acronym we use here in the States, it's not used similarly in Canada or Mexico. The USMCA, which is scheduled to enter into force, or hoped for to enter into force in early July this year, subject to the situation with the pandemic, limits severely access to investment arbitration. Investment arbitration is no longer available for disputes between Canadian investors and the US government or US investors and the Canadian government. It is still available for US investors doing business in Mexico, same for Canadian investors, but it limits very significantly the causes of action that can be brought against Mexico. It appears that fair and equitable treatment is no longer a possibility, and most claims appear to be limited to expropriation and discrimination. There are also very significant sectors of the economy which are carved out from claims. So it looks like the administration has managed to succeed both in avoiding investment disputes under existing treaties and curtailing its ability or its likelihood to be sued under future investment treaties, especially with the US and Canada, which had been traditionally a significant source of claims against Canada. How this all will fare remains to be seen. Will investors try to restructure and then have access to arbitration against Mexico through places other than the US and not through the USMCA, but maybe through a bilateral investment treaty that Mexico may have in place with a country in Europe? That's a possibility, and we'll need to see what tribunals decide about that situation if it comes to pass. A very quick footnote on how COVID-19 is affecting Mexico. It appears that the popularity of the government has plummeted for the handling of the crisis, but that's not unusual. Whether justified or not, similar plummets are being noted across the region. The one remarkable development, as you all know, is that oil and gas prices are down to historically low levels. It's unclear how that's going to affect the economy and whether that's going to trigger more aggressive behavior from private parties trying to recoup in litigation the margins they couldn't obtain in the normal course of business. Interestingly, however, Mexico, even though a very large producer of oil in the region, along with Venezuela, is, however, a much more diversified economy than, say, Venezuela or Ecuador, and thus probably a little bit less subject to impact by low oil and gas prices in the market. But of course, it remains to be seen what the long-term duration and effect of the crisis will be. So that's it in a nutshell, by way of quick overview. Noyan, I'm sure you have things to add.
Thank you, Aníbal, and actually a great quick overview with the time that we have. And hello, everyone, and thank you also, NAIAC, for inviting Aníbal and myself to do this, what we think is going to be a good way to accompany the attendees while they're having what I hope is a better lunch than the one you would have if you had been working from your offices. So I will just add one new development in Mexico in regards to commercial arbitration that I think we all have to keep in mind if we are doing arbitration in relation to either it's going to be enforced in Mexico or is seated in Mexico. There was a recent decision from the Supreme Court in December 2019, last year, which actually held that Now, all proceedings relating to setting aside of awards or enforcement proceedings of awards in Mexico will have to go through a three instances procedure. Just to give you a little bit more color on that. In the past, if you had a set aside or enforcement proceedings, you would have your first instant decision, and then that could be only challenged or appealed through what is called in Mexico amparo directo. And that was a one instant decision, and that was that would be your final decision. Since December 2019, now you can, if you're going to appeal a set aside or an enforcement proceedings decision, you will be using an amparo indirecto. And the amparo indirecto has two instances. So you will have a decision on the amparo indirecto, and that decision can still be brought in appeal one more time. So you're basically looking at a three-step process. This will, of course, add some time and some expenses to any set aside or enforcement proceedings in Mexico. And I think we should all keep it in mind if we're going to choose Mexico as a seat, or if we have awards that will have to be enforced in Mexico because the assets are sitting there. So that quick addition, I will move to Argentina. In all disclosure, I'm from Argentina, so it's my beloved country. Well, recent news as well has been going on the political scene in Argentina. As many of you might know, we have a new government since December last year. And what is very interesting about this new government is that the vice president, Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, is our former president. You might remember that Cristina Fernández de Kirchner was vice president and president from 2003 to 2015. And our current president is Alberto Fernández. And you might think that there are a lot of Fernández in Argentina, and you will be right. Unfortunately, to understand a little bit where we are today in Argentina, what is going to happen maybe in the next couple of years in terms of investment arbitration and also commercial arbitration, we need to understand a little bit what happened in the last 10 years. And I will be very quick, but just to give you a brief overview. You might remember that under the prior government of Cristina Kirchner, and also under the government of his late husband, Néstor Kirchner, Argentina became one of the countries with most investment arbitration before ICSID. So I think we had between ICSID and other type of proceedings around 52 investment arbitrations against the country. These arbitrations were mostly the result of major modifications to the tariff regimes that were applied to public utilities, mostly owned by foreign investors, and also as a result of the nationalization of the national airline. You will remember Aerolíneas Argentinas, which became state-owned, and also the nationalization of the national oil company, YPF, that was also owned by Repsol in that case, and was nationalized by the government. In addition to that, Argentina, by the end of the government of Cristina Kirchner, entered into a recession and a financial crisis, and started defaulting on some of the debt. That also was the reason for two big mass claims arbitrations before ICSID. It was the first time mass claims type arbitration was brought before or under bilateral investment treaties. So that was a case that I'm sure you were familiar with, Abaclat and Oficios. So by the end of the government of Cristina, the country was in desperate need of international financing. It also needed more foreign investments. So the government of Cristina Kirchner changed a little bit the prior attitude towards foreign investors and also towards investment arbitration, and decided to pay all final awards that were pending by that time, and also invite new foreign investors to invest in the oil and gas sector. And you will remember that Argentina has the Vaca Muerta deposits, which is one of the largest in the world in non-conventional resources. And also the government of Cristina Kirchner tried to renegotiate or negotiate with the holdouts, with the bondholders that had not accepted the prior settlement terms. Unfortunately, that was unsuccessful and ended up in a huge litigation in New York. With all that, there were elections in Argentina, and in 2015, Mauricio Macri came to power. Argentina was in a difficult financial situation, so his promise was to reactivate the economy, basically by two means: attracting foreign private investment and also obtaining funds from the financial markets, and basically reestablishing relationship with the IMF. First things that he did in order to start getting back to the international scene and gain some credibility, he settled the dispute with the bondholders, with the holdouts, and that was a big success for his government, and also settled the pending investment arbitrations that were still being processed before ICSID or other forums. And he also paid all final awards that were available. So with that, he was ready to go out and get more debt, and he did, and try to activate the economy. Unfortunately, for many reasons that we won't have the time to discuss in this podcast, it didn't work, and Argentina continued to be in a recession and in a financial economic crisis that basically resulted in Cristina Kirchner being re-elected in 2019 as vice president, as we were discussing with Alberto Fernández. So the question, or the big question mark when she came to power, was, okay, what is going to happen? Is this government going to be very similar in its attitude towards foreign investors as it was the prior Kirchner government, or would be more moderate, given that President Fernández was seen to be a bit more moderate? Unfortunately, we don't have an answer because we have had only a couple of months of government, and with COVID-19, all of the activity in the government, of course, is being directed to addressing the crisis. The only thing I can say is, so far, and a little bit different from what has happened in other countries, Fernández has been seen as having managed the crisis in an outstanding way, and people are really supporting him. So that could be good news going forward. Where does it take us, all this political context, in terms of what's going to happen in terms of future disputes? In terms of investment arbitration, it is to be noted that to address the current crisis and prior to COVID-19, the government started again, similarly to what it did in the years 2000, to freeze public utility tariffs and denied some of the increases that were supposed to take place. It also discontinued some of the subsidies that had been granted to the oil and gas sector, and also challenged some of the settlements of the disputes that Mauricio Macri had approved, in particular one with Abertis, one of the Spanish investors, claiming that there were some alleged corruption in the settlement. So if we look at all that, and we look at the economic situation of Argentina, which will with no doubt be worsened by the COVID-19 situation, we can see that many of the commitments of the government with foreign, even the existing foreign investors, are not going to be complied with. So it is possible that we're going to see a new wave, although probably not as big because there are not as much foreign investment as it was in the early 2000s, but we're going to see new cases coming under bilateral investment treaties. Argentina is also trying to renegotiate again the external debt. It has been unsuccessful to reach an unsuccessful in reaching an agreement. So we might end up having another Abaclat or Oficio in the future. So in short, what I feel going through all these developments is that this is a déjà vu. We're a little bit back to square one in terms of what is going to happen in the investment arbitration field. Excellent. So with that, I leave Aníbal to add something.
Thank you, Noyana. It was very clear, and it's always hard to speak about one's own country, right? I'll make a couple of very quick remarks on Argentina, mostly from a commercial arbitration standpoint. Number one, what's your counterparty risk if you're based in the US or overseas from Argentina and your counterparty is based in Argentina? Well, a couple of things to remember. One is Argentina has, since September 2019, very strong foreign exchange and currency convertibility controls. So even if you obtain, say, $10 million award against someone in Argentina, you might still go or have to go through many hoops in enforcing the award to try to collect exactly $10 million. You might be in for a bit of a surprise. So keep an eye on those controls and regulations. Number two, how does Argentina fare as an arbitration seat and even in terms of enforcement of foreign awards? For many years, despite its very natural conditions to be a significant arbitration hub in the region, I think Buenos Aires has been hampered, and international arbitrations tended to be seated more often in places like Santiago or Bogota or Panama City than in Buenos Aires. And I suspect that was in part due to a couple of circumstances. One was the investment arbitration crisis that Noyana was describing, and which I suspect somehow colored the view of arbitration participants about the soundness of the courts and their legal regime in Argentina. And in effect, the country's never been at the harsh levels that other big cities have been. That may be changing after, and that has to do with the second reason probably for the low numbers, which was that Argentina had a very piecemeal, fragmentary arbitration regime with some regulations in the federal codes, a lot of alternative competing statutes at the state level. There was some risk of interaction and confusion. Some of that has been resolved as of mid-2018, when Argentina enacted a new arbitration law, the arbitration law, really, that pretty much copies the ancestral model law. So it's now, the law is still in its early stages of being applied, but I suspect the signs are going to be much more promising to see how Argentina evolves and grows into a steadier and better established arbitration seat than it's been probably for the last decade or two. So with that, I'll stop on Argentina. I don't know, Noyana, Reca, if you think we should go into Ecuador?
Yes, please, to Noyana to begin us on Ecuador.
Thank you. Well, Ecuador. Again, in Ecuador, we have a relatively new government, although it has been in place for a little bit longer than the priors we have discussed. So in April 2017, the then vice president, Lenin Moreno won the presidential election. You might remember that around that time, Ecuador was submerged already in an economic crisis. It had a huge external debt that it had to honor, and it was in much need of foreign financing and foreign investments. So a little bit in a 180-degree change from the prior policies of the former president, Correa, President Lenin Moreno announced in 2018 that a package of economic measures that were aimed at many things, but one important one was to promote private investments. So, including foreign investment. So it's a new program of PPPs in infrastructure, oil, energy, mining, and telecom sectors. Also the privatization of some state companies, and also decided to pay some pending exit awards, notably the Burlington versus Ecuador and the Petrobras versus Ecuador awards, because that was one of the conditions for getting access to the international financing market. President Lenin Moreno didn't have an easy task, because you might remember, if you were following Ecuador or investment arbitration in general, that under the presidency of President Correa in Ecuador, Ecuador withdrew from the exit convention and also denounced all of its bilateral investment treaties in different stages, but by the end of the term of President Correa, all of the BIT had been denounced. In addition to that, there was a new constitution in 2008, which basically prohibited the state to enter into international treaties which would provide for arbitration with investors outside of Ecuador. And there was only one exception that was a dispute with investors from Latin America and before regional arbitration centers. So with it, this legal framework, you know, it was not very easy to attract new foreign investment. So President Moreno did a couple of things to try to address the situation and kind of rebuild the legal framework for the protection of foreign investment. First of all, called around 16 states to renegotiate new BITs and to replace the ones that had been denounced. This is a huge and very difficult task, as you can imagine. As far as I'm aware, there is no an official BAT model from Ecuador. I've seen some versions of some BATs that Ecuador was supposed to be presenting to some of the states, and some of the texts that I've saw, at least in my opinion, seem quite difficult to be accepted by other states. But we will see what the results of those discussions are. One of the main problems that the government is facing is they are quite limited by the 2008 constitution. So even if the government is able to negotiate BATs, the big question is, okay, what is going to be the dispute resolution mechanism of those BATs if the constitution prohibits foreign arbitration or invest in arbitration outside Ecuador? So to try to address this, the government went and filed a request before the Constitutional Court, requesting a clarification of that provision of the Constitution, that is the Article 422, and basically is asking the court to try to define whether under that constitutional provision, the government would be allowed to enter into international treaties allowing for arbitration outside of Ecuador. As of today, the Constitutional Court has not published its conclusions, and we don't know when it would be published. This has kind of paralyzed the process of negotiation of the new BATs, because it's one of the major concerns of foreign investors. And in case you are wondering what's the argument from the government for this petition, or the ones that say that it might be allowed, they're trying to draw a distinction between what it would be commercial and contractual arbitrations and treaty arbitration. So they say if the arbitration with a foreign investor is commercial or contractual in nature, it might be forbidden, but investment treaty disputes relate to international obligations of the state and might be allowed. We'll see what the decision is. Just to quickly know that there have been amicus curiae presentations where many people who are basically against or trying to modify the investment arbitration system have made presentations to try to support that Article 422 is interpreted by the court in a way that wouldn't allow arbitration in the new BITs. The other development that the government has undertaken is the passed a law in 2018 in August, que es la Ley de Fomento Productivo. It's kind of a promotion of economic development law. And it's also trying to open the country to foreign investments, particularly when they are based on investment agreements with the state. And this has been a huge development in Ecuador. And basically because it allows these disputes to be resolved through arbitration, including seated outside of Ecuador. And if the dispute is over 10 million, the investor can start arbitration under the ICC rules or the ancestral rules administered by the PCA. So really going back to the typical international institutions that provide support and guarantees for investment arbitration, for international arbitration. And in that law, the government also included a provision that said that now international arbitral awards are immediately enforceable in Ecuador without having to go through recognition by the domestic courts. That has also been a huge development because in the past it was an internal or a local proceedings, kind of exequatur type, that meant that many of the awards took a long time to be recognized in Ecuador. So in general, we can say that things are looking good in Ecuador in terms of opening to foreign investment and trying to readdress or recreate the legal framework for that. Although there are big questions marks in terms of what the Constitutional Court is gonna decide in terms of whether arbitration can be included in the VATs, and also how much comfort foreign investors are going to find in this new law, which provides for arbitration for investment agreements with the state. So with that, Aníbal, I'll give you the floor in case you want to close with some final remarks.
Excellent. Thank you, Noyana. I'm not sure there's much to add, but maybe if I could raise a couple of points, it would be this. Number one, the Lenin Moreno administration is on its way out. They were sworn in May 2017. Again, it was a change within the system. They were democratically elected, and they democratically and without significant constitutional changes, albeit some were made, they were able to change significantly the policies from Mr. Moreno's predecessor, President Rafael Correa. So it was again the system working in a significant way and without much disturbance of the overall constitutional architecture. But Mr. Moreno himself a couple of times made the comment that he was going to bury President Correa's or Mr. Correa's earlier policies, and to a large degree he has. But Mr. Moreno's popularity has plummeted. There's an election coming up in early 2021. A new administration is likely to be sworn in. It's unclear who the leading contenders are going to be. so far the names of Guillermo Lasso, an economist and pretty much a pro-investor politician, and Jaime Nebot, who has been for decades now, at least for many years, the mayor of Guayaquil, appear to be the leading candidates, but that's the type of thing that may change at any time. So I suspect in 2021, Ecuador is certainly going to be a country to watch, because there might be legal changes or at least some developments that impact arbitration significantly, which leads me to the second comment. The big elephant in the room with Ecuador is, I suspect, the massive amount of foreign debt that the country has amassed over the years. It's not clear whether all that debt has been publicly and accurately reported. Even if you go with official reports, the per capita indebtedness or of the country greatly exceeds that of any neighboring country. I mean, it's by far the most heavily indebted country in Latin America. And there may be more than what the eye sees. There are talks about the likely risk of default. I think Latin Lawyer was carrying a story on that very recently. Some of the biggest debt holder, the most significant debt holders when it comes to Ecuador are China and Thai sovereign funds and entities. So there are rumors that Ecuador is already negotiating with debt holders a potential haircut or delay in payments. And even if the talks are not yet ongoing, it's very likely, given the overall global economic crisis, that the talks will need to start very soon. So for investment arbitration funds, I mean, this might be ghosts of Abaclat and all the cases somehow coming back to life. That's something to keep an eye on. And on top of the investment arbitration cases that might follow, there's of course the risk of global disruption of the government if there's a sovereign debt default or a renegotiation. Lastly, how's the government doing with the COVID-19 situation? You probably know that Guayaquil has been probably the most and worst affected city in Latin America. The death toll is still unclear, but what's clear is that the pandemic has hit it very, very hard. The government issued decrees to try to put some, if I may, order in the madness and clarified that there were some economic sectors that could stop their activities and where force majeure declarations would be accepted. Among those exempted from halting their activities was the energy sector. Energy companies, and that includes government-owned Petroecuador, were asked to continue with business as usual. They were not allowed in principle to give force majeure notices or disrupt operations in light of the pandemic, but the good wishes were short-lived. The rain season came and the two biggest pipelines in Ecuador have been heavily affected. OCP and SOTA have been very affected. They had to disrupt operations because of landslide in the wake of the rains, and they're still going to need several weeks worth of repairs. So you have, in a way, the perfect storm coming up in Ecuador with global pandemic, economic crisis, and disrupted supply chain. I suspect that's going to lead to an uptick in arbitration claims, not necessarily against the government, but even among private companies, which might be unhappy with the scope of force majeure declarations or the lack thereof. So that's what I have to say very briefly on Ecuador. And thank you again, Noyana and Rick. I look forward to the questions from the audience, if we still have time.
Yes, so if you all will bear with us, cognizant that we're running towards the end of this, we'll take very brief questions. The first posed about the Argentina deja vu, right? That this panelists have spoken about in general deja vu of these jurisdictions, but to Noyana, what does that look like? Assumptions therewith.
Hello.
Sorry, the floor is yours, Noyana. So if you want to describe a bit more about that deja vu that you were speaking about, and Anibal, any additional comments thereafter?
Yeah, of course. I'm sorry, like, it's a titanic ask to address three major countries in probably a decade in each of them in 30 minutes. So I'll give a little bit more details on what my assumption was. What I can see from before the pandemic was that the government had already started freezing tariffs. So there were several tariff increases that had to take place, particularly in public utilities like electricity and gas transportation and distribution companies, and those didn't take place. Something similar happened with the toll roads, which also had at least two or three tariff increases that were due in the last couple of months, and again had been rejected by the government. There has been an order from the executive branch saying that tariff increases are going to be suspended, and this was prior to COVID-19. So this was the reason for many of the investment arbitrations that we had in the mid-2000s. So if I can see how these companies are going to suffer as well in terms of the pandemic, and in addition to having those tariffs already frozen, I can see that in the future, maybe one of the possibilities is for them to go back to investment arbitration, bearing in mind that it's going to be a long process as it was in the past, and that enforcement is not going to be either easy or fast, but at the moment might be the only option that they have if they cannot negotiate something in the short term with the government.
Thank you, Noyana, for that. I want to introduce the CLE code for those listening in that want CLE credit. The code is 7551. Again, that code is 7551. Mark that, and you can send it in per the instructions provided in the original email. Another question. Do you believe that prospective new investment disputes against Argentina could involve old claims that were renounced subject to certain states' commitments that have subsequently been not met? For example, integral tariff review, et cetera.
Noyana, do you want to fill that?
Okay. Yeah, I can start on that. It will pretty much depend on the terms of the settlement agreements that were signed. To my knowledge, many of the settlement agreements imply a renunciation of all prior claims. But of course, any additional losses that are resulted from after the time of the settlement, of course, will be included. Prior to that, no. But it's important to see the exact terms of the settlement agreements, because of course they differ.
Okay, and another follow-up. Argentina is a hot button item for questions, so we'll stick with Noyana. Anibal, please jump in as you feel appropriate. A question on the COVID-19 outbreak and its effect on tribunal decision-making. Could the pandemic give rise to stricter criteria in the assessment of the merits of the investment claims against states?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question. I don't think it's only applicable to Argentina. I think we are all going to see in the sector, we will have to actually observe what the tribunals are going to decide when there are claims that in some way are related to measures taken during the COVID. So as always, first thing will be to look at the treaties. There are treaties that have much more freedom for the state to regulate. In general, if the state is regulating under public policy reasons and to take care of the health and the population, they will be accepted, taking into account if they are, these measures are taken in a non-discriminatory and non-arbitrary way. So I think what we will start looking is at all of the measures that have been taken, and if for some reason they are not proportionate, or they are not, or they are discriminatory, or they are taken with the excuse of COVID-19, but in reality didn't address COVID-19 issues, I think there the tribunals are going to be looking at those as potential breaches to bilateral investment treaties.
Right. It's going to be like the Argentine 2002 crisis on steroids, right? You're going to see state of necessity defenses making a comeback, and then there's going to be the discussion of, was there really necessity? Was the measure really targeted to addressing a crisis situation? Was it proportional? It's very interesting, and I think when we look back into the crisis 5 or 10 years from now, we're going to surely find a much more developed state of necessity case law on cases because of the predicted amount of claims where that's going to become an issue in the next few years.
Okay, let's take another question here about, and acknowledging the time, we're going to go hard stop until 1. So I thank you all for your questions, and to Noyana and Anibal for staying engaged with them. It's with regards to the 2018 Argentine arbitration law. Do you consider Argentina as an appealing seat in light of this? The comment being, in addition to having a new administration, Argentina adopted this modern law, but is taking a conservative approach.
So I was tempted to ask that very question to Noyana while we were still in the main session, so to speak, or in the dialogue between both of us. I'm very interested in her views. I think she's probably the one who's closer to the facts. I'll say, I don't think it usually takes just a law to develop a favorable arbitration climate in a jurisdiction. You need much more than that. You need well-trained judges. You need a consistent body of case law applying the act. You need a legal community. So this goes beyond the judges. This includes also the arbitrators. This includes the lawyers, who are well acquainted not only with the Domestic Arbitration Act, but more generally with the international network of treaties with which the act somehow interferes or touches on. And in the case of Argentina, I mean, that means the New York Convention, that means the 1975 Panama Convention. There's still some of the old Montevideo Conventions that are arguably in force in the region. You need to be cognizant of all that and know how that impacts your arbitration. So I guess it's a long way of saying, I think the act is a good first step. If I were to make a guess, I don't think it's going to suffice. You're going to need more. And in particular, you're going to need more support to arbitration from the powers that be, so to speak. That includes the government. I think commercial arbitration has been the unintended victim of some administration's hostility to investment arbitration. And this hasn't just been a problem in Argentina. It's been a pervasive problem around the world, including in Spain, where I hail from. The government doesn't like investment arbitration, and then somehow vicariously and indirectly commercial arbitration becomes the victim because it's not supported by the legal framework, the administration. It's all treated as one and the same, when in fact you could draw a line in the sand and say, listen, it's one thing when we, Argentina, are sued in investment cases and we don't like it, and this is how we intend to defend in those cases. But we believe that commercial arbitration is a very reasonable mechanism for resolving contractual disputes among private players, and we're going to support it, among other things, because it will free up our judiciary and it will let it focus on other things. So that's my uneducated guess on the subject.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. Just having a modern arbitration law is one piece of the puzzle. The second one and the most important one in every jurisdiction is consisting a rather long practice from the judicial that shows that it's a respect for the law and respect for arbitration. I think in Argentina, we will need a couple of years before people will be confident in choosing Buenos Aires as a seat for arbitration, particularly when we have the state or state entities involved in the arbitration, because we have had really bad precedents in the past, and it will take a while before people get comfort that there is a new era and the courts now are much more respectful of arbitration.
We'll take one final question. This is about Mexico and the Mexican government's effective turnaway from the policies of the prior administration. Does this include policies or acts of the prior administration that may have resulted in investment claims?
So that's a very good question. And the short answer is, I don't know the full answer, because you just know what you know. There's potentially a big universe of claims out there, asserted and unasserted, that hasn't surfaced. The one thing I'll say, and this is more based on anecdotal evidence than on hard data, is that it appears that the Mexican government, the current administration at least, is making a concerted effort to look into existing claims and review them, some of them from scratch, once again. They may have been filed under previous administrations, but the government is reconsidering them and sitting down with investors, or at least with some investors, to determine whether there's a way to put an end to the claim. But again, I don't know everything about all claims asserted. I suspect, and this is again at the risk of relying heavily on personal experience as opposed to contrasted information, I suspect that governments across the region and even outside the region learned a lot from the experience of Venezuela in the early 2000s. Venezuela managed to settle many claims, but interestingly, it didn't settle others initially that ended up going to arbitration. Venezuela was at some point the most frequently sued government in the world before ICSID. And finally, many of those cases that were eventually brought against Venezuela ended up being settled in the course of the arbitration or shortly after the award was issued. And I think the lesson from that is, if you're going to end up settling anyhow, you may just want to try harder at the beginning and spare yourself the bad publicity. And my sense is that's something that's badly ingrained in many administrations, and they are trying to follow that practice. But again, I'm sure that people in the audience or Noyana have much more to add on this and have been exposed to cases that I'm not aware of.
No, and on Mexico, I don't have direct knowledge of. I know that there were rumors that the government was reviewing existing claims, but I have no direct knowledge of what they are planning to do with that. But I totally agree with you and Evil that some governments have been a little bit more, in a way, more intelligent in the way they looked at the claims. Venezuela settled most or a lot of the potential claims resulting from nationalizations, and also Bolivia. We normally see us Bolivia as a difficult country for investors, but in my experience has been that with some exceptions, Bolivia has always looked at the claims and where it could, they were settled quite early. And even when they were not settled, they were paid all of the awards. So there's always this this notion that as a public servant, it's very difficult to settle a case because that could be challenged by the following government, and you might be liable for a settlement if it's considered that was not in the interest of the state. And I think that creates a lot of inefficiencies and a lot of unnecessary costs in the system. We should all start thinking about whether when the claims are reasonable, and I'm talking about some might be more difficult to decide in an early stage, but an expropriation is an expropriation, then you can discuss about quantum. I think it would be good for the state and also for the investors and for the system if we could look at those claims in a more realistic way, and those who could be settled were settled early.
Totally agree. And by the way, we're now in podcast 2 territory, right? We're talking about Bolivia, Venezuela.
Correct.
this is the well-rehearsed plan for everyone to hopefully join us again in just a few days.
Yes. So with that, thank you beautifully for the segue, acknowledging that we couldn't respond to all of your questions, particularly some that came in about COVID-19 and its impact for a state's lack of preparedness. But I assure you, there will be another time to pose that and other questions in our next podcast. So allow me, on May 21, you'll get more information about this, episode 2, Peru, Bolivia, and Chile, and June 11th, episode 3, Venezuela and Brazil. And so we'll be beaming into you then. We hope you'll join us and you'll find more details. Again, the CLE code is 7551. I want to thank Noyana and Anibal, and to all of you for tuning in. It's really been a pleasure for all of us. And on behalf of the three of us, we wish you continued good health and safety in these unprecedented times. Again, our international arbitration community, as we know it, is resilient and flexible, and we are indeed all in this together. So thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stay well.